Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it on social media. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. That means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. So, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it's perfect for those with those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold. Hot flashes and night sweats, racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep and feeling tired all the time, occasional bloating and gas, no desire to be in bed next to someone, if you know what I mean. Yeah, Hormone Harmony can help with all of these things. And the biggest benefit, feeling like myself again. And that's what women mention over and over in the reviews. There are over 17,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use our code, which is the acronym of the podcast, TSNOTYAW, at checkout. That's the podcast acronym at checkout at happymammoth.com.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.
There and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode. We are working on our Books with Hooks this morning. So excited to have another edition with you guys. As always, I'm going to read our little disclaimer. Just a reminder, this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. And here are some of the ways that you can support us. Rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Tell all of your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many authors as possible. Follow us on Substack for our newsletter. You can get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis. Bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. I actually have a really fun segment coming up for our Substack on Fridays. I'm going to start putting out, I think it's going to be about in May. I have a whole huge whack of query letters from published authors that were so generous to share them with us. And I'm going to put those in there so you guys can see what does a query letter look like that actually got picked up by an agent, got a book deal, so you guys can actually see the real deal. So that series is starting on our Substack. I believe starting in May is when I'm going to roll that out. So I'm really excited to share that with you guys. So definitely make sure you are following us on Substack if you are not. Today, we have a very exciting guest with us for our awesome, awesome Books with Hooks, a very special edition, because this person who is joining us is my former assistant. And if you guys have been following along on socials, I announced I was looking for a new assistant because my assistant was leaving. And obviously very exciting because, you know, of course, they're off to a wonderful new job. And now they have landed at this new job and my new assistant is about to start. So I thought, hey, what could be a better way to introduce you guys to my former assistant? and launch them into their new career as an agent. So here we go. Here's the official bio of Joe Ramsey. Joe is a literary agent at the Transatlantic Literary Agency. They've worked in publishing for over 7 years at places which include Simon & Schuster, PS Literary Agency, Shrapnel Magazine, Arsenal Pulp Press, Prism International, and Greystone Books. Their writing has been published in The Globe and Mail, Maclean's, This Magazine, and among others. Pronouns, they, she. Welcome, Joe. We're so excited to have you on the other side here on the podcast.
Thanks, Carly. It's so exciting to be on the podcast. Thank you for having me. Parting is such sweet sorrow. I'm going to miss being your assistant, but I'm also really excited for this next era and my ascension to literary agent myself.
Absolutely. Yeah. So as I said, I thought what better way to introduce Joe to all of you guys, and you guys can actually pitch Joe now at Transatlantic Agency. Here's another agent for you guys to access. And Joe is going to help us out with the critiques today. So we're actually going to start with Cece's critique, and Joe will chime in and I will chime in as well, just as usual. But we have, as I said, our special guest. So clap to Joe for the promotion in terms of moving up to the world of literary agenting. Couldn't be happier for you. Okay. Cece, it is your turn to read the query letter.
So glad you're here with us, Joe. Welcome and congratulations. This is so exciting. All right, here's our query letter. Dear Bianca, Carly, and Cece, thank you so much for everything you do with The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. Your podcast, Substack, courses, deep dives, and social media posts have been an invaluable resource and really kept me motivated while I wrote this manuscript. I'm submitting this query to Cece because of her love of stories that feel like straight up contemporary fiction, only to surprise the reader with a speculative twist. Though I will be grateful for any feedback from all three of you very wise people. Below this paragraph, my query letter is 333 words. Secret Rivers is an 80,000 word upmarket novel with a twist based in climate science and Slavic folklore. Told in first-person POV and set in present-day Toronto against a backdrop of climate change, it is the story of a woman struggling to come to terms with the latent powers an unexpected pregnancy is awakening inside her. Anastasia Stash Petrovic is 35, single, pregnant, stuck in the job and apartment she's had for a decade, and leans heavily on her best friend Nick and her sister Gala for support. Stash's pregnancy comes with an array of unusual symptoms, including static electricity, nightmares, sleepwalking, and an uncanny ability to smell changes in the weather. A disturbing surprise encounter with Marco, a man she had shared a traumatic experience with in her teen years that resulted in the death of a stranger, makes Stash suspect the changes she's going through are connected to Marco and to her Serbian heritage, which she struggles to reconcile with her first-generation Canadian identity. Stash must find and confront Marco before her pregnancy and a massive storm that threatens Toronto both becomes too dangerous to handle. Secret Rivers is for any reader who's ever wondered whether their worst flaw might be their superpower. It will appeal to fans of stories about characters who are caught between two cultures, as in Sanjena Sathian's magical realist Indian-American coming-of-age novel Gold Diggers, and Jessica John's Bad Cree, which also features a protagonist with premonitory dreams. I'm a Serbian-Canadian writer and film producer living in Toronto. My fiction and nonfiction has been published in the Antagonish Review and Tattle Creek Magazine, two Coach House Books anthologies, and in my own Substack, Cat's Compass. I have received two grants to work on this novel from the Toronto Arts Council and Canada Council for the Arts. When I'm not writing or helping filmmakers, I can be found on nature walks with my husband and our curious 8-year-old. Thank you for your consideration. May I send you the full manuscript? Katarina.
All right. Thank you so much for that reading. I think you guys all heard this. It was 333 words. So Cece, just give us your take. What did you think on that query letter?
Okay. So I do want to say that I very much do love contemporary fiction that surprises me with a speculative twist. So yes, thank you for knowing my taste. This is so awesome. Okay. So this is a small thing, but there's a line that reads that her pregnancy has unexpected symptoms and nightmares is one of them. And I don't think that's actually that unexpected. I think it's quite common that when you're pregnant, you have like more vivid dreams, including nightmares. And then later down in the comps paragraph, there's a mention of like premonitory nightmares. So I would just bring that word up, right? Like, because it's not just that she's having nightmares. She's having nightmares that are coming true, which is a totally different thing. I also kept wondering, like, if she's sleepwalking and having nightmares, wouldn't she just assume that it's like a sleep issue as opposed to the pregnancy. And maybe this is just me because I have so many sleep issues that I keep trying to find sleep issues anywhere. I didn't know if the encounter with Marco, because there's mention of trauma, was like they shared trauma, as in they both went through trauma, or like he caused her trauma. And I don't know that I need to know this, but the two things are very different. And I guess I kind of wanted to know, like, what am I supposed to feel about Marco? Am I supposed to be like, oh, Marco the bad guy? Or am I supposed to be like, oh, you know, her and Marco have like an unlikely alliance because of something they went through? Like, I just wasn't entirely sure. I do think that the way things are framed here, like the changes she's going through are connected to Marco and her Serbian heritage. And, you know, she must find and confront Marco. Like, I think that you're withholding too much. Like, I don't know what the plot is about. I read the plot paragraph twice and I was like, okay, what happens here? What actually happens in the story? And I don't know. I imagine you're holding back because your story is super interesting, super exciting, and you don't want to give away the goods, right? Like, no spoilers. And I get it because you want us to be surprised when we read the pages, and I love being surprised too. But we need a little more, because right now I don't see how Marco even comes to the equation, and I don't see what this has to do with truly anything. I like the idea that the massive storm is at the climax, because usually that's very good for storytelling, right? Like everything leading up to a storm, like that's excellent. But I need more clarity on the inciting incident and how it connects to the rising action that will then lead to that climax. So these are my general thoughts. Yeah, curious to hear what everyone else thinks.
Absolutely. Before I start, Joe, do you want to chime in? What did you think about this query letter?
I thought this query letter had some really good tight paragraphs that get out the elevator pitch, but I think it could have used a few more details. So even on a word choice level, the word climate change, I think, is a bit broad. So the line against the backdrop of climate change is maybe even a little bit buzzwordy. I suggest being a little bit more specific or intentional with the wording. For example, are we talking about floods? Are we talking about droughts? Are we talking about both? Especially because climate change is so different all over the world and how it affects location to location. I want to know how Toronto specifically is being impacted in this story. Another thing to be mindful of is that climate change can mean a lot of different things. So sometimes stories that center climate change have a connotation of pitting the environment against humans as the conflict. And it could be good to be clear if this is the type of story you're trying to tell or if it's not. Again, just like Cece said, Cece had some really great points. The conflict is that Sasha must find Marco before a big storm arrives in Toronto. But what's at stake and what happens if she fails? What's the danger is what I want to know.
Awesome. Thank you, Joe. I think both of you guys, you know, hit on tons of things I was going to say. I highlighted the same thing, which is the idea of climate change. Like, we're living in climate change now. So this idea that, like, against a backdrop of climate change, I'm like, that's contemporary. Like, that is real life, you know? So I agree. It's like, what about it? Is it drought? Is it floods? Is it an extreme version of climate change? Because it says it's set in present day Toronto against a backdrop of climate change. I'm like, well, that's just, like, as I said, like, that's our life. So yes, I totally agree with that. My note was, what is different about it? Is it more extreme? I don't know if this was clear to you guys. It's not clear to me, but who is the dad of the pregnancy? And like, is this an immaculate conception? Because it's like, she's single. She has a best friend, Nick. Did she sleep with Nick? Or is it has something to do with this Marco character? So maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe that's the whole point, is just like, she's just a single woman and we're not meant to know who the dad is. That is also completely fine. So I don't know. That was just a bit of an interesting flag to me. If it was climate change, immaculate conception, I'm like, well, that is a very interesting plot point. Yeah. And I also had the same note, which is, it says Stash must find and confront Marco, which is like, where is he and what's at stake if she doesn't find him, which echoes exactly what Joe said. So as I said, I think, you know, there's a very interesting concept here, but we haven't really dialed into exactly what's unique about this, and we haven't really figured out all of the stakes. And maybe you, as I said, you know, as the author, you know all the stakes, and that's perfectly fine. But in order to hook us as the agents, you definitely have to let us know how we can kind of sink our teeth into this and get excited about it. So those are my notes. Okay, so Cece, can you give us a summary of what is happening in these opening pages now?
So the protagonist is in the bathroom taking a pregnancy test, and she's at her parents' house and she can overhear them and their extended family chatting from a distance. The test is positive. She exits the bathroom thinking that she needs to talk to her sister. She observes her sister thinking of how together she is while the protagonist is the mess in the family. That seems to be her role. Her uncle asks her if she's in the same job and she says yes, and then thinks to herself she's in the same everything. She feels a jolt of electricity as she opens the door and notes that they're in a full moon. She grabs a toolbox to fix the deck railing. Her mom approaches her and they have a very sweet conversation in which the protagonist avoids looking at her mom too directly because she's convinced her mom will be able to tell the secret she's keeping. And then back in the kitchen, her sister approaches her.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Cece. And what did you think about those opening pages?
So we have Joe as our special guest today. So we will have three people critiquing a letter. So I'll keep it at two notes. That way we have lots of things to talk about. So I think the first note I want to mention is a very micro thing, but it's very important. I want to talk about first lines. The first line here is, "Sweat trickles down my forehead as I slide down to the cool tile of the bathroom floor." What is wrong with this first line? Absolutely nothing. Nothing's wrong with the line, right? I, however, think, and this is just a matter of opinion, that it's not the best line. So it's not that there's anything wrong with it. You're just not leveraging a storyteller's superpower. Let me explain what I mean by that. You are currently choosing a line that's purely descriptive. You know, we're seeing the sweat trickling down her forehead and we're seeing her slide down to the bathroom floor. It's purely descriptive. It's very well-written descriptive, very clear descriptive. Great job with the descriptive. But that's something a camera can capture. And remember that you are writing a book. And a book's superpower, the thing that sets a book apart from Netflix, from Amazon Prime, from HBO, from TikTok, from anything, right? Like, is the fact that a book can get inside someone's head. And no other medium can do that in the same way with the same specialness and psychological acuity. So I would start with interiority, not narration, interiority. So not something that's purely descriptive. And so I think that that's really important. And if you know, if anyone's thinking, what does it actually matter? It's one line. You're going to read the second one like less than a second after finishing the first. First lines grab your unconscious brain. It's just one of those things. So much of why we like or don't like a book is actually not something we know how to explain why or don't as readers. And first lines really matter. So that's something that I would work on. Okay, the second thing I want to touch on is this. This character finds out she's pregnant, right? How someone responds to being pregnant, especially an unexpected pregnancy, says so much about them. Are they thinking about money? Are they thinking about job security? Are they thinking about healthcare? Are they thinking about, to Carly's point in the query letter, the father? Is she going to tell the father? Does she know who the father is? How is the father going to react? We're not getting a lot of interiority on this pregnancy. Right after she finds out she's pregnant, she goes out and she observes her niece trying to trick her sister, who is her niece's mother, into getting cookies without, you know, her sister seeing it. And there's no thought process on how she would process that centering herself. So here's an example. She could see that and think to herself, you know, with my own child, I would let them have as many cookies as they wanted because I know what it's like to grow up being told I can't eat something. And that made it worse for me. And that's right there, a curiosity seed, because I'm thinking, oh, was that her childhood? How did that make it worse for her? How did this contribute to her development? And again, that won't apply here, I'm sure, because there's no way I'm guessing, right? But it's more the concept, right? Like every single thing she observes has the potential to share character development, to share something about her psyche and her psychological makeup that's unique to her. And that's really, really, really important. Like you want that. And you don't want that in every single paragraph because that would be exhausting. But I did highlight a whole bunch of opportunities I think that you have here to dig deeper, to show messy emotions and connect that with the discovery of the pregnancy. There's a line where she mentions that her sister is the one who switches between two cultures so effortlessly and then speaks in English with her. And then there's a really great line that reads, as if I don't remember the language, as if I'm like Alex, just a Canadian. And that's a great detail. But again, she's pregnant. Is she thinking to herself, oh my God, my kid really will be Canadian? Like my kid will have nothing? Or is she thinking, no, I'm going to make sure that my kid has lots and lots of access to my culture. What is she thinking? Is she even thinking of having a kid? I don't even know, right? But point is, we need to really dig for the layers of messiness. I want to see complicated emotions. And complicated emotions are emotions that contradict each other. You see something that makes you feel warm and glowy and fuzzy, and that makes you feel guilty. Or you see something that makes you feel guilty and that makes you feel angry. Whatever it is, you have to dig. It's like mining for diamonds, right? Like you have to dig. And I just wanted you to dig more, which is actually a really great detail because it meant that I was curious and wanted to know more. So these are my 2 cents. I really wanted more psychological depth and acuity. And I'm curious to hear what both of you think.
My favorite thing about that was Cece being concise. Cece's like, I am only going to talk about 2 things. And then goes off on like 7 sub-tangents. So I love that sneaky, sneaky 2 things from Cece.
That was two things. Yes.
Let's all remember that. Cece's clients must get lots and lots of notes from Cece. Okay, Joe, what did you think?
I think Cece touched on a lot of really important things here. Interiority, big word for me as well with this. And as well as the sister Gala, like she really stood out to me as something of which is a reflection of the way that Sasha sees herself and her upcoming pregnancy. So a good opening couple of pages, especially opening lines, will cause the reader to ask questions. And I felt like I'm asking questions about Toronto and the storms and the family, but I don't know if there's enough on the page right now in terms of Sasha's interiority that make me ask questions about where she's at. Maybe more directed questions. Like, I want to know how she feels about the pregnancy. I want to know who the father is, but I don't feel like those questions have a direction, if that makes sense. So we have a first person point of view and we're in Sasha's head, but the majority of the time she's in the bathroom, she's listening to her family speak and chat downstairs. And in the first person point of view, that's a great opportunity for Sasha to like to reflect, I guess. I think Cece touched on something really interesting when she mentioned a camera can do that. And I think there's a lot of really wonderful scenes in these opening pages that feel like I'm a fly on the wall, that capture what a camera can see. But I kind of want a bit more than that.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Joe. Thank you, Cece. I have one note to chime in on, which was, I was very disoriented by this idea that Stash was in the bathroom and yet could hear everything happening so clearly. Like, if you look at the actual dialogue, everything is in complete sentences from what she's hearing at the party. And I totally get that she, you know, when you're in your own house, you know exactly what it sounds like if somebody's moving from the living room to the kitchen. And she kind of explains all of that. But the fact that in her head, that's what she's doing, she's completely dissociating from the actual experience of being like, holy crap, I'm pregnant, versus like, I'm just going to listen to everything that's happening on the other side of the door. Either it's a very small house or the walls are very thin. Like, I just can't imagine, like, I was so stuck on this. I had a really hard time getting past this idea of like, how is she listening to complete sentences on a different floor in a different room while all the interiority of this pregnancy stuff is happening? It felt incredibly unrealistic to me, just again, being the reader that I am. And I really stumbled on this because it was so interesting to me. Then eventually she leaves the bathroom, but the sentences are exactly the same in terms of how they were crafted when she is in the room with the family versus when she's not in the room with the family. So as a reader, I'm like, I had no idea kind of when she left the room. There was a very short sentence, obviously, to delineate that. But my experience as a reader of being, when am I with her and what is she doing, was just too tidy, way too tidy for me. So that's the note that I have to add on to that.
Okay, thank you, Carly. Thank you so much for that. I really like that idea because it does really elevate the authenticity of the scene. All right, well, your readers, our next query letter.
Here we go. Dear Carly, Cece, and Bianca, thank you for all you do to support emerging writers. I'm an avid fan of the podcast, have participated in the beta reader matchup, and currently enrolled in the deep dive series. My novel, Touched, is a character-driven, story-forward novel that contains elements of female rage, dark cultural commentary, and feminist revenge, catharsis, all themes Cece recently posted on her Instagram, MSWL. Without this introduction, my query is 447 words. My debut novel, Touched, is a multi-POV, upmarket women's fiction novel that follows four women whose lives are interrupted by one man's misconduct. Touched will appeal to fans of the complex characters in Little Fires Everywhere, the female experience in Fleshman Is in Trouble, and the quest for vengeance in Big Little Lies. Touched is an examination of the double bind still trapping modern women as they grapple with the gap between the lives they imagine and the lives they live. Madeline Turner is a promising young attorney, pregnant with her first child, thriving in her first job out of law school until Benji Jenkins walks in the door. Benji is a partner with a corner office, successful, powerful, popular, practically a part of the law firm scenery, a predator waiting for his prey. When Benji assaults Madeline, he touches off a series of events that plays out over the next 6 years. Madeline reports the assault, but sacrifices her legal career. Determined to put the assault behind her, Madeline builds the family of her dreams and finds meaningful work. Meanwhile, Benji thrives without consequence and 5 years later announces a run for office. Madeline knows she must act to stop him, whatever the cost. Madeline is joined on her quest for justice by an ensemble cast: Eleanor, the young woman managing Benji's campaign whose high school abortion comes back to haunt her; Alexa, the senior partner at the law firm who was tasked with investigating Madeline's assault and now, once again, in a position to protect or destroy Benji; and Olive, who left her own career at the firm after being harassed and assaulted, but now wonders if a different choice could have protected someone like Madeline. In plotting to stop Benji, each woman must confront her own role and responsibility in tearing down destructive systems and ask themselves what it really means to be a feminist and to whom they are accountable. Through the eyes of these four complicated, ambitious women, Touched explores the shared, often invisible challenges that women face as they encounter the contradictions inherent in achieving the goals prescribed to them: careers, motherhood, marriage. I'm a writer, a reader, a lawyer, a former eighth grade teacher. I was a bi-weekly contributor to the New York Times Schoolbook blog in 2011 and 2012 when we were just recently accepted to the 2023 Northern California Writers Retreat. I sit on the board of a local literary arts organization, Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures, and I'm currently working on my second novel, a work of speculative fiction about a family torn apart by war. I live in Pittsburgh with my husband and three young children, Best Laura Mullen.
Thank you, Carly. So we got the word count for that. What did you think of that query letter?
All right. I want to jump into the, not the little introduction paragraph, but the next one. So in terms of the comps, you know, we talked about this a million times on the podcast about what's a good comp, what's right, what's too big, you know, what's too small, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm always shocked on this podcast, like how many times I can talk about comps, and yet you guys still have questions about comps, which to me just says this is one of the most complicated parts of the kind of positioning of authors' books, because even as agents, you know, we think about comps all the time. Editors think about comps all the time. Booksellers think about comps all the time. It is, you know, as I said, the challenge of our industry to kind of frame things. So I deeply, deeply empathize with this. So this is what I'm thinking about when I'm thinking about these comps. You chose three mega bestsellers that were adapted into television shows. They are great because they're obviously huge kind of touchstone books that really connected with people. They were very popular, but they're also like a bit larger than life, right? So it, as it shows an appetite, it also shows, you know, are these too big to be reasonable? Or what is it that you are comping to about these books? And you kind of explain, right? So the complex characters, Little Fires, Female Experience and Fleshman, Quest for Vengeance and Big Little Lies. So it's not that I disagree with it. I'm just flagging. I'm flagging that they are, you know, pretty big books. And to be honest with you, like Big Little Lies, Cece might know better than me because she's a huge Leanne Moriarty fan. But how old is Big Little Lies now? Like, is that book 10 years old at this point? It's not new. So that's one where I'm like, is that something that is the most relatable comp at this point? I think the Fleshman comp is interesting, especially as we get to the pages. But anyway, I'm just flagging that for you. And then that's what I think about when you're bringing these up as comps themselves. So multi-POV, super, super difficult to pitch. I have so much kind of understanding for this as an agent who pitches multi-POV projects myself. And all of it comes together with what brings these stories together, which you do a great job of, right? You're like four women whose lives are interrupted by one man's misconduct. Another comp that I think would be really great for you is my client Andrea Dunlop's book, Women Are the Fiercest Creatures, which has three female point of views, which all result around why their lives were imploded by one man's actions. So that could be a comp that would be useful to you. And so, as I said, you do have this idea that everything is coming together over one major plot point, but we do have these like very separate POVs, and I don't understand necessarily how all of these women's lives are going to interact, because as much as we do center this over a man and we have these kind of like female and often feminist agendas, I do want to know how they're all going to essentially join up. We get a sense that they kind of do, but it's not very clear. And I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. I am really hesitant about why we need four point of views, because if there is even one POV that I don't fall in love with, there's a lesser chance that I'm going to be interested in this book. So you have to not only write an incredible book, you have to convince me that all of these four point of views are absolutely essential to the storytelling of this book. And it cannot be done with two or three. It has to be done with four. And if you believe in your heart of hearts that you have written that book, great. If you do not believe in your heart of hearts that you definitely need these four point of views, that is some soul searching that I think you have to do to recognize whether, you know, it's working the way that you want it to. So, and that's what makes these query letters really, really hard. I have highlighted a paragraph that I think you can cut, which is the paragraph before the author bio. I don't think we need that. And I think your author bio paragraph is great. I'm going to throw it to Joe now. Joe, what did you think of this query letter?
Thanks, Carly. This query is great. It grabs my attention, but I'm going to start with the comps as well. I like how the query letter is specific with what aspect of a comps touched relates to. It's a great tool to say more about what kind of project your query is, but I try to be more specific. For example, the phrase complex characters and female experience are quite broad as descriptors. Try to dig a little bit deeper and be more specific. And as Carly had already mentioned, Big Little Lies and Little Fires Everywhere are comps that I see so much to a point where I think they've just lost meaning. I would say do not underestimate the power of picking different female-centered multi-POV books that aren't smash hits that everyone isn't comping to, because it'll help your query letter stand out all the more. Your query letter also does a great job of describing the inciting incident between Madeline and Benji and the power dynamics at play. I also appreciate how all four women that the book follows share a universe and that they're all connected through the one man. I think that's a really strong structure. I agree with Carly, though, that four is a lot to carry. Carly had also mentioned cutting the second to last paragraph that starts with, through the eyes of these four complicated, ambitious women, etc. It's giving me first paragraph vibes, and pieces of it could be incorporated into the first paragraph. For example, I really like the line, contradictions inherent in achieving the goals prescribed to them. That, to me, would be a great addition in the first paragraph. It's such a great nugget, even though the second to last paragraph feels like it's revisiting old ground that we've already covered elsewhere in your query.
Perfect. Thank you, Joe. Thank you for agreeing with me. All right, Cece, what did you think?
Yeah, just echoing both of your thoughts. I agree with everything you said. I think my biggest concern is that the first plot paragraph, one that starts with when Benji assaults Madeline, that to me reads as backstory. Because I'm like, this happened before the story starts, right? Like, I assume the story starts with she finding out that he's running for office and then they all do something. I don't know. Structurally, if that's the case, you have too much backstory in your query letter. And if that's not the case, then I don't understand where the climax is. Just like, I can't map this out right now, and I should be able to map your book out up until the climax. So yeah, I did highlight this for you. I wanted to see, how do they specifically plan to take him down? What specific obstacles do they encounter in present day? And how does this lead to rising action? I wanted less backstory. And I don't think it's bad that you have backstory in a draft, because I feel like that is really helpful to set you up emotionally in terms of like the emotionality of the story. But it might just be the case that you should rewrite this thinking to yourself, okay, all I can do is write stuff that actually happens in the present. Like, backstory can take one line and that's it. So Carly, will you tell us what happened in those opening pages?
All right, here we go. So we start with chapter one. We're in Alexa's POV. So if you remember from the query letter, Alexa is the senior partner at the law firm. So we are at Alexa's house. She is tasked with the annual party because the person who usually hosts the annual party, their house was under renovation. So she was kind of given that task, which is a bit of an honor, obviously, to have everybody over, but a huge responsibility because you have to host a party. She doesn't seem overly nervous, mostly just like has everything ready, you know, feeling prepared. She's been doing this a long time. So she gets it. She has a husband and one son who's approximately 16. His girlfriend is also over, which I found really interesting. And they kind of come downstairs. They look a little disheveled and she's a bit like, wonder what they were doing upstairs, but like, please get ready for my important party. So everybody starts kind of coming in right on time. The former host of the party shows up first, one of the other partners, and she's kind of just like feeling really like solidified in her career, you know, that she made it. She's not feeling pressure to kind of like go rub elbows with certain people. So she's just kind of, yeah, feeling in this steady phase of her career. She's kind of acknowledging that the Benji character, he is, you know, rubbing shoulders and rubbing up on some people that he shouldn't be, and kind of notices that a couple times and finds that, you know, something that she's been paying attention to because he continually, you know, just has his hand on people. So that's where we end.
Thank you, Carly. And what was your take on the pages?
So I thought it was really interesting that we started in Alexa's POV because it's clearly not Madeline. And Madeline was the character who most of the query letter is framed about. So we didn't really talk about this in the query letter itself, but that it's kind of suggested that maybe Madeline is the primary of the four POVs. And then we start with Alexa, which is like, okay, that's interesting. Potentially it is just like four equal POVs. There is no kind of main POV. I don't know. That was just really interesting to me that we started. So I kind of flagged that as just really interesting. Overall, I found her pretty distant. My note kind of that I made at the end of the first page was, I'm feeling really distant here. What's the real undercurrent? So far, there's really nothing unexpected happening. I'd love her to be hiding something. What's her secret? And that was kind of just the drop that I left as a note at the end of the first paragraph, or the end of the first page, sorry. And I'm just wondering, like, where are we going? You know, we end up just like, as I said, you know, in my little roundup, like she's feeling secure in her career and this and that. And, you know, even when, as I kind of mentioned, is, you know, she's talking about her son and the fact that like he's at the party. And I was like, oh, that's so interesting. Like, you know, he escapes back upstairs. And why was he at the party? Like, would you want your kids at the party? Would you not want your kids at the party? Did she raise them to appreciate that kind of life or not? I think she has two kids, but I can't remember. So one of you correct me if I'm wrong, because I think there was maybe another kid, or maybe it's just the husband. But yeah, the 16-year-old, she kind of just says, yeah, he goes back upstairs. I just thought it was really interesting in terms of like her parenting. Is it just so rote in the sense of like, this is so normal that we're missing a lot of interiority because it's not unique to her to like have a lens to drill down on the specific situation, which made me feel really distant as a reader. I felt pretty disconnected to this character because, again, she didn't really have any secrets. Like, she wasn't really hiding anything. She just, I don't know. Yeah, just felt a little distant, you know, even when she was talking about what she was talking with some of the other characters and saying, you know, asking where they're from. And somebody said, like, I'm struck by what a small world it is here. I think of this as a big city compared to the town I grew up in, but everybody's connected here. Alexa tries to remember where Madeline was from, somewhere in Ohio, maybe. And I was like, that's the perfect opportunity for her to be like, is that similar? Like, did she grow up somewhere like Ohio? Did she grow up here? So she can't imagine living in the Midwest or like what that experience was like. Just every opportunity that was given to learn who she was more, we just never really got. And there was a line actually where Alexa, in her point of view, this is third person, but she says something about the party being here in her home with her son upstairs kept her from leaning into the evening. She felt strangely removed. The version of herself who lived in this house didn't want to network or grovel. But the fact that you're saying that she feels removed to the situation actually also means I felt extremely removed from the situation because she is my lens into the scene. And if the characters whose lens into the scene is feeling distant, then I don't feel connected to this. I just kept waiting, like, where's the secret? Like, did she have some sort of lover who was also at the party? Or what's she hiding from her husband? Or, you know, she needs to pay the caterers at the end of the night and the check's gonna bounce. I don't know. Also, I've been watching Palm Royale, the new TV show on Apple Plus, and I'm like, anything can go wrong. So much opportunity for drama. So I've been binging that. And that's a great show and I highly recommend it. So maybe that's the lens that I'm coming at it with.
Thank you, Carly. Joe, what did you think of the pages?
I agree with Carly in that the individual characterization of Alexa and different characters were introduced could definitely use some beefing up so we can connect to them more strongly off the bat. But I also just want to be complimentary of how an ensemble has kind of been set quite quickly. And I really appreciate that. So just the writing in general, I want to go back to the opening line and the opening paragraphs. They're descriptive, they set the scene, and they also invite the reader to ask more questions. For example, I'm really kind of obsessed with the line, a stolen kiss, a joint snuck out in the yard, a bottle of whiskey gone missing, rumors flew, the truth irrelevant, the mystery fostering exactly the firm unity the party had been designed to manufacture. Just wow, in such a short amount of time, I know exactly the kind of workplace this is. They're professional, but there's a lot of things that go on under the surface that maybe shouldn't in a workplace. And I just really appreciate how this scene tells us a lot about the environment, tells us a lot about the characters are up against, and also just intentionally or maybe unintentionally builds conflict. As Carly was, I was surprised that the first pages were not in Madeline's POV because she's such a big focus in the query letter. But I am intrigued in the idea of being introduced to a character through another person's eyes, in this case, Alexa. So I don't know, I'm intrigued. I kind of want to see where it goes. I'm not against it. It has my attention.
Thank you, Joe. And Cece, what did you think?
I agree that I felt removed as well. And when I got to the line where the protagonist recognized that she was removed, I was like, oh gosh, it's intentional. And listen, it's obviously your choice. You are the author, but I don't think that it's smart to start a story with the protagonist feeling removed because, like Carly, I also felt that kept me from staying connected with her, that kept me from connecting with her. So yeah, I would revise. I would revise her emotionality. We need more active emotions. She's doing a really great job of narrating the facts around her, but it's not centered in the messy emotions that we all feel, especially in social situations. And as an example of how you could deepen the emotionality, right at the beginning, she sees her husband and he says, it's going to be great. And then Alexa forces a smile and there's a line that reads, not wanting him to see that even after 20 years with the firm, she had nerves about a work party. She could feign social graces, but lacked Spencer's easy charm. And I'm thinking to myself, why isn't she comfortable showing him her emotions? They're married, you know, like, is there something interesting there? I really love sweet interactions, but they only work, for my taste, if you show layers of messiness and interiority. So you're seeing a husband who's supportive of his wife and a wife who loves her husband. That's great. But what messiness is going on through her head that will add layers to that? I don't mean to suggest that the messiness has to contradict the sweetness. She could still be a loving wife and he could still be a supportive husband, but there has to be more complications, more layers that go into it, or else, like, what's the point of being inside someone's head? Because there's always more to it. So I don't know. I kept highlighting instances where I think you can dig deeper. and really let us into her psyche, because I think that's really important. But, you know, I will just say that when it comes to setup and stories about women coming together and like your query letter mentions revenge catharsis, that's all stuff I'm really interested in. So you clearly have a premise with a lot of potential. I just think you need to dig into the emotions more.
All right. Well, that is it for our Books with Hooks segment for today. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you for Joe for being our guest. We're so happy about your new job. So everybody, query Joe Ramsey at Transatlantic Agency. And Joe, we will see you at many publishing events in the future.
Did you know that 70% of all books are sold online via e-commerce? If you're an author wondering how you can get some of that market share, this is for you. Hi, I'm your co-host, Carly Waters, and I'm here to tell you how writers can work on their author brand to build an audience and convert those followers into book buyers. Do you ever wonder why so many authors publish their books and later say they didn't sell as many copies as they wanted? It happens over and over, and it's all over social media. Authors really think it's a them problem, but not always. They really just weren't shown the way. And I don't want you guys to launch a book and show up at book events and have two people in the chairs. I have helped clients launch books to the bestseller list for over 15 years. I have now built a 6-module, 10-hour course with all my knowledge, and that will give you the craft and book business information that you won't find anywhere else. And there's an app. Over 100 of you have already joined my new course. And writer Siobhan Moore said, I'm halfway through the course and grieving that I didn't have this information sooner. There's really nowhere else to find it. Worth every penny. Thank you, Siobhan. If you want all that info and everything that will change the course of your writing career, go to carlywaters.com/course to learn more and use discount code POD15 for the month of April at checkout. That's POD, POD15 at checkout over at carlywaters.com/course.
Calling all memoirists. I'm so excited to let you know that I've put together an incredible all about memoir lineup for Saturday the 11th of May from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, in which 6 amazing speakers guide you through everything you need to know to write a memoir that will sell. You'll get opportunities to ask questions of best-selling memoirists while also standing a chance to have your query letter live critiqued during the webinar. To see the awesome lineup and to register, go to biancamaray.com. There's an early bird promotion for the first 50 delegates who sign up. Come and join us and get your memoir groove on.
Hi, everybody. My name is Bronwyn Keyes Bevan, and you may know me as newsletter editor at The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. But today I am very excited to be here on the podcast because I get to interview an author whose book I simply adored. I gobbled this book up, and I'm so delighted that I get to interview our guest today. And so, speaking of, our guest today is the wonderful Fiona Williams. Fiona's novel, The House of Broken Bricks, is out from Henry Holt on April 9 in the US and Canada. And it's Fiona's debut, but it's already the winner of the very prestigious Bridport Prize. Fiona is originally from Southeast London. She now lives in the West Country, which for our non-UK listeners is in the southwest of England. And she is currently completing her PhD in creative writing at the University of Exeter. The House of Broken Bricks is her debut. As I said, it's absolutely gorgeous. I just adored it. And The Guardian had this to say about it. The House of Broken Bricks is a tender and powerful novel, all the more profound for its apparent simplicity, and establishes Williams as an exciting and original new voice. Fiona, welcome. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Bronwyn. Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited. I have like a million questions, so I'm just going to dive right in. For our listeners, The House of Broken Bricks, it's set in the English countryside and it's told over 4 seasons by its 4 main characters. So we have Tess, a Londoner who has left the city behind and lives in a tiny rural village that her husband is from. Then there's her husband, Richard, who is a fruit and veg man, and his business is struggling a bit. He's also nursing a bit of a drinking problem. They have 10-year-old twin boys, Sonny and Max, and the boys are basically watching their parents' marriage kind of slowly implode. And they're also navigating a lot of like a very complex relationship with identity. I mean, so I should say the boys are biracial. Their mom is black, their dad is white, and they look quite different to each other. So Max, unlike his twin Sonny, is white presenting. And so as well as all of that going on from the outset of the book for the reader, there's kind of this feeling like, oh, all is not as it seems, or all is not well. And I found this story, it's very skillfully, very masterfully revealed. It happens very slowly and beautifully. And so I have a ton of questions, but I'd love to ask you a little bit. I saw in your bio that your background is actually in biological sciences. So I'm really interested to know about that shift from the science world into being a writer.
Okay, the shift from science to writing, it was unexpected. I will say that I didn't have dreams growing up of being a writer, not at all. It's come out of the blue. I'm a big reader. I love books, and I've always been a really avid reader from when I was very little. I fell into science almost accidentally because my mum, Caribbean background, really wanted me to be a doctor. But I had other ideas and I didn't get the grades I needed. So doing science was kind of a way of just kind of going, look, see, I'm doing something worthwhile. I was really interested in nature and wildlife and just the whole kind of biology of things. So it seemed like something I would get into. And I mean, I've been doing it for years. So I graduated with a degree in biological sciences, and I've worked for over 25 years as a science writer for the pharmaceutical industry globally. So very different from creative writing. It's very structured, formulaic, precise, no creativity at all. I don't know what it was. I'm realizing now that I think it was probably just a midlife crisis, because I was in my early 40s and I just thought, this isn't what I want to do anymore. I would like to have a go at writing. I started sort of doing some small bits and pieces here and there just to see what it felt like, but without any kind of training or kind of experience of writing. So that's why I decided to do an MA, just to get some kind of feedback and some structure. And it's all kind of ballooned from there, really, unexpectedly.
Well, it's funny. Yeah, you say it's ballooned, which sounds negative. But what Fiona, I think, is referring to is this is her debut, and she's already won this because the book is out in the UK already, and it's won this very prestigious prize. And I can see why. And so I'm delighted that you've gone this route and that things have ballooned in this way. I think that I wasn't like so completely surprised to find out that your background was in biological sciences, because so there was something about the book, like I often think, and I don't know if you agree, but I often think about storytelling as there's kind of like different layers, shall we say. So you have like your plot and your character, you have the kind of ideas or the themes that you're exploring, and then you have the language, and they can be quite separate, those things. And, you know, great books do them all very well and they're all braided together. And when I'm a writer too, and when I'm writing, I'm kind of like, something's got to go. But you didn't have to do that. Like, your book has it all. And so in terms of the language, especially, I was so impressed by, for example, like your use of figurative language, which for our listeners who probably know this already, but just as a little reminder, when we talk about figurative language, we're talking about the use of metaphor or simile. So for instance, when you see F. Scott Fitzgerald in Tender as the Night, he says the sea is green as green milk, blue as laundry water, wine dark. And obviously we know it's not laundry or milk or any of these things. And Fiona in The House of Broken Bricks, the figurative language that you use, I believe, is almost always rooted in nature, but even more so, like so specific to the bioregion that the story is in. And I really wanted to know, I'll give our readers a little example. So there's this line where Sonny says about his mum, her voice feels as soft as the lamb's ears that grow along the garden path. Or there's another part where Richard, the husband, says, guilt is what he feels when he looks at her, guilt like bindweed among the cabbages, rooted deep. So I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about that. Like, was that something that happened spontaneously and then you revised for? Did you know from the outset that that's something you wanted to do?
I will be honest, I didn't know from the outset. I hadn't a clue what I was doing at the beginning, really. A lot of the way the book has sort of fallen together has come unexpectedly. I think the whole kind of idea of plants and the growing of things and that rooting into the soil is something that is a really big part of who I am. And so I think my general thoughts are often around kind of how we connect with nature and how our emotions and behavior can be reflected back to us through nature. And so I think with this book particularly, because I was concerned mostly with the seasons and how things grow in that season and the way that feelings get entangled up in the growing. I think those were kind of the things I was thinking, and then I just let the language come as it did, really.
And then when you were revising, it just kind of came in the first draft and stayed throughout. Was there any time where you thought, okay, that's happening and that's something I sort of want to amplify?
Yeah, I mean, when I look back at really early drafts, and especially was on the MA and I was still kind of feeling my way into the story, trying to figure out, was I going to be able to do this in 4 points of view? How was I going to structure the reveals? I think at that point, I did get myself kind of tied up in that thought of, it has to feel like a book. It has to read like a novel. And you kind of, for me, I didn't realize at the time, but it was quite restrictive. It wasn't until after the MA finished, and I think I kind of talked myself into believing that it was, nothing was ever going to come of it. It was just something for me to write for myself. And at that point, I kind of thought, to hell with it. You know, all the things they advise you not to do, I'm just going to do them because I like how they feel when I write them. Even though, you know, everyone, like teachers always say, pare things back and keep things simple. And I thought, I don't want to be simple. I want to make it as complicated as I can possibly make it. And as pretty as I want it to be. And I think I thought at that point that nobody would be reading it, so I could kind of just be free. So I did just let loose. It was probably by then, I'd say probably on my fourth draft, because I kept going back. I kind of, the way that I seem to write is I do a first that's got loads of holes. I do a second, I fill in more holes and smooth it. And I kind of keep going back and back and smoothing it like pizza dough, just going back and kneading it again and again. And I think at that point I just thought, I'm just gonna do what I want with it. And I like words, and I like the rhythm of words and the song in literature. And I thought, I'm just gonna let it go and listen to this in my head as I write it, as though it's music. And just, I wanted to paint the images for myself so that when I'm writing them, I can forget that I'm writing and just be completely present in whoever's character's head I'm in at that moment. I could just be Max or be Tess and feel it through them. And I think that's when it came together, I think, when I'd let go.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I'm so delighted that you were like, you know what, guys, like, screw this. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And just, it sounds like you were saying, like, because that pressure was removed, you were able to be fearless, mm-hmm. and just, you know, kind of do what you wanted to do. And it's funny, you kind of set me up for my next question, because as I mentioned at the top of this, like, it is told from 4 different perspectives. And so a lot of our listeners will have already written or be in the depths of writing multi POV stories or even just dual POVs, and know that that is like no mean feat. And so one thing that really, really struck me, so there's the 4 points of view, and obviously there's differences. We've got mum, dad, 2 10-year-old boys, and so there's an age difference. You know, obviously if you're an adult or a child, you're going to have different observations, a different mindset. And you also chose, so mom and the 2 boys, they're parts are written in present tense, first person, I am doing this. And then we see Richard, the dad slash husband, and he's in present tense, third person. So Richard was going out to the shed. So there's all these differences, and yet the whole thing just hung together so cohesively. Like, you know, you mentioned you love words, and that didn't surprise me, like that the musicality of words and the lyricism is important to you, because like I found this book, it was like hypnotic. It felt like a dream. It felt like an unbroken work. And I thought, how has she done that with like 4 different voices? So yeah, if you can tell me about the magic that you worked there.
Oh, that's funny. I was told not to do it. On my lips, like, don't do that. You're setting yourself up for disaster. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to give it a go. I really want to give it a go. It was hard in the beginning, definitely, especially with the children's voices, to try and really get that genuine feeling of a child's perspective. I think where the breakthrough came for me with all 4 in general was I had to get to know the characters really, really well. So there was a point in earlier drafts where I had to step back and go, right, I don't know them well enough. I feel like I'm forcing them to do things and I need to actually know them as people. And I think I did take the time to go back and do character studies and really think about my characters so that when I come to write them, and I would write them depending on the mood for the day, if that makes sense. So I couldn't force a character to be written on a certain day. I had to be in that person's mood. So if I'd been out walking with the dogs, or we had sheep and goats and all sorts of animals where we were living before. And so when I was outside and I was really feeling connected, it'd be a sunny day. And so it would be right there. I'd go back in and I would be sunny. I would try and think like him, imagine the world like him and write him. So each character kind of got their own separate time in my head. And in terms of the points of view, there are a few reasons really why I chose to mix that up. I think the first is for Tess and the boys. They're the three out of the family that are kind of the ones who feel slightly at odds in this village setting. So obviously Tess is black and she's got two biracial children in a very, very small farming village rural setting. And so for them, there are questions around identity, questions around belonging. And so I really wanted to get up close and personal with them so that you can kind of walk with them through what that feels like to be kind of alone in a situation like that racially. Whereas for Richard, being born in the village and being, you know, local, he didn't have those kind of same worries, even though obviously he's got loads of other worries. So I kind of felt that I didn't want to give him that same access as the other three. Also, from the point of view of kind of what happens in the plot, I wanted Richard to feel slightly removed so that you couldn't see through first person what was going on in his head and the motives for some of his behaviour. I wanted that to be something that you kind of, you'd see it as the others saw it. As Tess and the kids see that behaviour in Richard, the reader would see it at that stage, not be with Richard whilst he's doing things. So I think that's one of the main reasons as well.
Yeah, it just totally worked. Like, I just was so in awe, actually. I was just like, goodness, she's not made this easy for herself. And then you just totally like pulled it off. So I was really, really just in awe of that. And something else I really love, speaking of POVs, is obviously two of the points of view are children. And there's something very special about child POVs. And when I was reading this book, I kept thinking, you know, that phrase, out of the mouths of babes, because Sunny, both of them, I think, but there was, for instance, there was this one bit where Sunny is talking about his mom. And so to remind listeners, so they live in a very, very tiny rural village and Sunny's mom is black. She's the only black person in the village, basically. And so Sunny says, so when a black delivery driver turns up at our house, mum acts embarrassed. She fusses with her hair or picks fluff off her clothes. Then she speaks with the same voice she uses for Nana and Auntie Peaches. It's like she's saying, yes, I know it looks like I live here, but really I don't. And I just thought, like, oh my goodness, the way that this 10-year-old has very believably, there's like not one second that you're reading that thinking this isn't a 10-year-old boy, but the way he just like cuts through all the posturing of adults and cuts so close to the bone in terms of Tess. So Tess is a Londoner. She's living in the West Country. Her background is Jamaican. She grew up in the city and now she's very much in the countryside, living what we would probably think of as, you know, very kind of traditional rural white lifestyle. So obviously Tess has this shifting feeling of belonging, identity, and I really loved exploring that through her point of view, but to see it from a 10-year-old, just like so sharp. So basically, I mean, I guess my question for you is like, what was it like writing children's points of view? Was it fun? Was it a challenge? Was it something that you had to work on?
It was, I think for Max particularly, it was a challenge for Max in the beginning. So I'd never written from the voice of children before. I do have a son. And at the time of writing the book, he was a little bit younger than 10. But whenever his friends would come around, I would observe them. And just the way they spoke to each other and kind of the body language and things like that, which helped me quite a lot. But I think it was something that just took time. And it was something that I think first step was mastering the first person, really. And from a child's perspective, especially from Max's perspective, he's very active. You know, he's not just sitting around thinking like adults tend to do. He's always doing something. So it was feeling my way into that action and how 10-year-old boys, especially in a rural space where they've got all this room to run around, how they would be moving. And then I guess kind of trying to live life through his eyes. You know, if I were that age, what would I, trying to remember when I was that age, what would I be looking at? What would I notice? What did I notice about my own parents growing up? What was important to me? And I think it was taking things, a mixture of that, and probably from my own children and thinking about the things that they notice, because they are quite sharp and they catch me out all the time. So I know that children are a lot more conscious and with it than we give them credit for. So yeah, I think it was a gradual thing. But then once I got the rhythm of them, then it's not that it was easy, but it was very comfortable. I think in terms of enjoyment, I think I'd have to say Sunny was the one, even though I love Max's character and his was, I felt really satisfied when I managed to nail that. But Sunny was just a very different feeling. I think Sunny was kind of probably channeling some of my inner childhood feelings, especially his kind of observations of nature, because I was a huge nature freak when I was a kid, massive David Attenborough fan. I wanted to be his researcher. That was like my dream job. It didn't happen, obviously. And so I think for him, it was much easier. He tended to come really late at night when I'm really tired and I should be going to bed, and I'll be sat at the kitchen table and it'd be like, I can feel I'm having a Sunny moment. And then something I would have seen that day would just trigger something. And I'd say he was probably out of all three characters, the most free flowing to write, where I didn't have to think and plan him out. I could just relax and in that kind of dream state in the middle of the night, just let whatever comes out. And funnily enough, during the editing process, those are the bits that remained unchanged, I think, most unchanged. So obviously I was tapping into something that just wasn't there in the daylight hours. I don't know what it was.
That makes sense. No, because when readers read this book, I think Sunny does, he has, it's almost like a dreamy stream of consciousness. I loved all of the people, to be honest. They were all so different, like all of the characters, but like I had a little soft spot for Sunny. So none of that surprises me. I've got my eye on the clock. I think we have time for one more question. I have this question. I'm really interested to know what you'll think of this. Basically, I wonder what your feelings are around the kind of potential collapse in the reader's mind between Tess as a fictional character and you as a writer, because obviously there are some similarities. You know, you're both from London, you both have a Jamaican background, you both live in the West Country. I believe until recently you lived in a house very like the house that's in this book. And so I'm not asking how much of it is autobiographical. I'm a writer, so I assume all of it. Just like, you know, everyone you write, everything you write, it's like you've taken it from somewhere. I don't assume everything, and it'll make sense why I don't for the rest of this question. But basically, you know, I think I do it as a reader as well, and maybe you do too, where you are a separate person to your characters. Do you have feelings? Do you feel like a bit stressed or a bit self-conscious about the idea that readers are reading this and they think, oh, Fiona is Tess, Tess is Fiona. And so all of Tess's problems, like the breakdown of her marriage or, you know, her less charitable thoughts or, you know, her husband's growing drinking problem, which like all of this we can assume is fiction. Like, does it stress you out that people might collapse those, or are you like a way more chill person than me?
I have thought about it, and it has already happened where people have sort of said, oh my gosh, is, you know, are you Tess? I'm like, no, I'm not Tess. And I tell people the only thing in the book that was real is the house. Some of the things that she experiences I can definitely relate to, and I have experienced similar. Other things are things that I've just heard from other people, even things I've read in the press, you know. So across rural villages across the UK, there are, you know, now and again things come up and I've read about them. So I guess I kind of collated all that information. My husband gets very worried that everyone's going to think he's rich as well, so he's he's probably more concerned than I am. So I'm not too worried about it, and I think that will be something that as people kind of get to know me and see me, and they will realize that I'm very different, because, you know, I can't cook like Tess. I'm not good at cleaning. I'm not very domesticated at all. I'm dreadful. I also couldn't stay. I couldn't stay at home, and just, yeah, I'm a very different person. I'm always busy, always on the go. So I hope that it comes across that I'm not Tess. But if it does, I don't mind. I don't mind. I think I'm trying to see myself as a writer now, which is something that doesn't sit quite comfortably with me just yet. Even though I know I've written this novel, I think for me, I would need to write another one or more before I feel that I can say that I've kind of, you know, it's something that I do. And so I'm kind of hoping that with future work as well, it will show that, you know, this one was probably quite close in certain areas to my experience, but the things I'm hoping to do afterwards take different slices of who I am, I guess. I guess you're right that, you know, everything comes back somehow to the things you've experienced. So I've been a bit like a cat. I've had many lives. I've lived in lots of different countries. I've been quite fortunate because of my career. So there's other wells to tap into. So I think it hopefully will become apparent as I go on.
I love that. I'm also glad to hear that you are much more well-balanced than I am. My therapist will be listening to this and like, Bronwyn, take notes. Well, Fiona, you might not feel like you're quite a writer yet, which is ridiculous to me to hear. I read this book. I adored it. I couldn't believe it was a debut. I felt like it's so assured. It was so, what's the word I'm looking for? I think The Guardian said, you know, it's apparent simplicity. This is not a simple book by any stretch of the imagination, but I think like any great writer, any great artist, you make it look easy. And I loved chatting with you today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.